From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Africa is like a human being, and Fela is his most beloved bodyguard. Fela has thrown himself actually in between Africa and the whip. Fela has thrown himself between Africa and the bullet. Fela has even actually lost his mother because of what he believed that Africa should be or should not be.
Nigerian musical giant and social critic Fela is dead. More than 180,000 Teamsters are striking against UPS. We'll look at pensions, part-timers, and profits, and more on Scientology. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Teamster strike against United Parcel Service is now into its second day. So far, neither side is budging. The chief negotiator for UPS says the company has made its last best offer. Dave Murray acknowledges the longer the strike, the greater the impact. He says businesses will grind to a halt. The Teamsters union says the company is playing a dangerous game and will talk with union members in just a minute. According to the New York Times today, the Immigration and Naturalization Service would be disbanded and its responsibilities farmed out to other federal agencies under a proposal by a bipartisan commission. The INS in its current form suffers from mission overload, according to a draft copy of a report by the U.S. Commission on Immigration Reform obtained by the Times. Under the proposal, the Justice Department, currently the parent agency of the INS, would retain responsibility for controlling the border and removing illegal immigrants. The State Department would oversee immigration services and benefits such as citizenship applications. The U.S. Supreme Court yesterday agreed to hear the case of Thomas Martin Thompson just hours before he was scheduled to be executed for the 1981 rape and murder of his roommate's former girlfriend. On Sunday, the full Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals blocked Thompson's execution, saying his lawyer's incompetence raised a grave question about whether he's guilty of a capital offense. The state appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which could have reinstated the order to execute Thompson by injection at 12:01 this morning. Instead, 6 hours before he was scheduled to die, the high court agreed to review his case, putting the execution on hold again. Thompson had already said his goodbyes to family and friend who'd been visiting him. A small explosion caused minor damage to the lobby of the luxury Hotel Melia Cohiba in Cuba early yesterday, and the third hotel blast in the Cuban capital in as many weeks. The Cuban government, as it has with previous hotel blasts, blamed U.S.-based terrorists for the explosion. Seven former U.S. Secretaries of State have called on Congress to pay America's bills to the United Nations, saying that failure to do so will undercut the U.S. effort to reform the World Organization. They made their appeal in a letter dated July 25th to Senator Jesse Helms, chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and a staunch UN critic. The text was released yesterday by a group of prominent Americans who support the United Nations. Israel arrested dozens of Palestinians yesterday and demolished four houses built by Arabs in Jerusalem without permits. Actions Yasser Arafat said were aimed at humiliating the Palestinian people. The Palestinian leader, who later went to Jordan for talks with King Hussein, said Israel is intent on meting out a collective punishment for last week's bombings in Jerusalem. All federal Department of Energy plants were ordered yesterday to take action to prevent accidents like a recent explosion on the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Energy Secretary Federico Peña's directive, issued in Washington, D.C., came in response to a final report on the May 14th chemical tank explosion at Hanford's plutonium reclamation facility. Hanford officials said corrective actions ordered by the secretary already are underway. A day after handing over the remains of four U.S. soldiers killed in the Korean War, North Korea is joining South Korea in turning to the task of forging a lasting peace on their divided peninsula. The talks, also including the United States and for the first time in the ongoing dialogue, China, were to be held today at Columbia University. The exchange began in March when the United States and South Korea first proposed that the four governments negotiate a permanent peace settlement to replace the 1953 armistice that ended the fighting in Korea. An Air Force lieutenant argued today at a public hearing that her affair with a married officer did not affect her job. Lieutenant Krista Davis said the military has no business judging her personal correspondence and letters to the Air Force Academy instructor who fathered her child. She insisted it was her private life. Davis is willing to leave the military. She accepted non-judicial proceedings rather than a court-martial. A spokesperson at Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana says the hearing was open at her request. You may remember that Krista Davis was a guest on Democracy Now! About a month ago. And in the next stage in his war on tobacco, President Clinton plans to sign an executive order this week imposing the broadest smoking ban on federal property ever enacted, including a prohibition on lighting up outside office building entrances, this according to administration officials. The armed forces and many federal agencies already restrict smoking. However, until now, departments have had discretion in writing their own rules. And you're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In one of the largest union struggles in years, nearly 200,000 UPS workers nationwide went out on strike yesterday, crippling the country's largest package delivery company. But if you wanted to find out what the strike is about in the mass media, you might have had a hard time. Many newspapers and TV accounts focus almost entirely on the strike's impact on American business or consumers. And you had to read the fine print to discover why some 185,000 workers are out on strike. We're joined now by two of those workers. We're joined by David Pratt, who is a former UPS loader and organizer for Teamsters for a Democratic Union, a rank-and-file reform organization that supports present Teamster leader Ron Carey. Also joining us on the line is Anne Marie O'Neill, a part-time UPS worker on the preload shift at a UPS center in eastern Long Island, New York. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's start with Dave Pratt. Can you tell us why you're on strike?
I think the bottom line in this strike is respect. UPS has shown that they have little respect for the needs of working Americans. The issues of dependable full-time jobs, safe work environment, the right to pensions that people have control over, and retirement with dignity. These are all issues that are at the heart of the strike.
Can you talk about pensions and what exactly UPS is demanding?
UPS has proposed that the pensions be shifted from a Taft-Hartley fund, a union fund, to a company-controlled fund. And we have little confidence in the decisions that could be made in the near future or down the road with the monies that would be in the fund.
So UPS is asking for control, and currently the Teamsters have control over the pension.
Exactly.
What are, in terms of the other issues, what about the issue specifically of part-time work? Can you explain what is the issue with 60% of the unionized jobs at UPS being part-time?
UPS would like to expand the use of part-time jobs. They're at, as you mentioned, roughly 60% now. They'd like to see that grow. We think that those are throwaway jobs, that people deserve the right to jobs that they can live on, that they can build a family on, jobs for the future. And we'd like to see that trend reversed, where we see a growing number of full-time jobs at UPS.
You know, I should say that we did call UPS repeatedly yesterday, and while they did try to get someone to be on the show, they said no one would be available at this hour. Anne-Marie O'Neill, you're a part-time UPS worker. What do you see as the problem with part-time work, if you do see a problem with that?
Yes, I do see a problem. What I see is a company that makes $1 billion in profits a year refusing to acknowledge that part-timers work very hard at UPS. And, in fact, the starting wage at UPS has been frozen for part-timers since 1982. The part-timers work very hard. It's a difficult job, and they're not rewarded. The company keeps talking about how they're rewarding their workers and what a good contract they're offering us. But unless you understand and you can read between the lines on this contract, you can see that they would like to just keep as many and increase the number of low-wage workers. They used to be 80% full-timers, 20% part-timers. We now have about 60% part-timers.
Anne-Marie O'Neill, can you describe what you do all day? Could you just describe a typical day?
A typical 4 hours or 3 hours at UPS?
Yes.
Well, I can give you a general overview. I generally work in the small sort area where we're handling packages that are, you know, fairly small and usually under 10 pounds because we do have some safety issues. Then we have loaders who load package cars, like 3, 4, or 5 package cars within a 3 or 4 hour period, which then 4 or 5 drivers go out and deliver those packages. And, you know, production is a very important thing with UPS. That's why they make so much money, because their people work very hard and, you know, they're expected to produce so many pieces per hour. You know, there's all kinds of jobs going on in the preload, which is the operation before the drivers come in.
You know, it's interesting how powerful these delivery companies are, UPS and FedEx. Months ago, I remember in Congress when one of the bills, which wasn't particularly related to anything to do with a delivery system, an amendment was put on it that said that FedEx workers would not be able to unionize nationwide. And on Democracy Now!, we had a number of FedEx workers who'd come to Washington to lobby against this amendment. And ultimately, they lost. And FedEx, very powerful. In fact, FedEx, I believe, is now one of the clients of Haley Barbour, who was the Republican National Committee chair and now is a lobbyist in Washington. Let me ask Dave Pratt, who is an organizer for the Teamsters for a Democratic Union, how powerful UPS is, you know, how you think this, for example, strike will turn out. Will President Clinton intervene? What will be Congress members, senators' view of this strike?
Well, I guess that's two questions. UPS has shown itself to be very aggressive. They tried unsuccessfully to lobby to come under the Rail Labor Act in an effort to escape the protections that workers have under the National Labor Relations Board.
Like FedEx did.
Exactly. They also, over the past several years, have pushed very hard and lobbied very hard to got OSHA protections, and so far that's been unsuccessful. So it's a very aggressive corporation, and I think part of their concern is that they see the union growing in strength because of the reform efforts over the last half dozen years. They see a union that's revitalized and stronger than it was at one time, and they don't like that. They'd like to turn back the clock to a time when they had more control.
How does UPS in size compare to FedEx and the U.S. Postal Service, both which are dealing with, to say the least, a very heavy workload in these days of the strike?
Well, I think you can see it practically just by the effect the strike is having. The post office and FedEx and the other carriers can't handle the volume that UPS is not covering now. They dwarf the other competitors. They're a giant. As Anne Marie mentioned, they made over $1 billion last year.
Where do you see this strike going? Anne Marie O'Neill, do you expect to be out for a long time? This is the second day of the strike.
Well, we just got an update on the contract, and it looks like Carrie really tried to compromise with what UPS called their last, best, and final offer. So, it looks like UPS is really playing hardball here, and I wanted to bring up safety if I could. Safety is a real issue at UPS. They're more than double the industry standard on injuries. And I see one of the things they want to do is, in their final offer, is increase the weight limit above 150 pounds at any time. We had a walkout, a one-day walkout, few years ago on that issue when they increased it from 70 to 150. And I think it has increased our injuries since then. So that's a big issue, and I wanted to bring up safety since I'm involved in that at work.
That's also very interesting in light of this study that just came out that said, yes, people's jobs are killing them, or at least hurting them, and this is nationwide, just looking at jobs around the country.
Well, it's a stressful environment, and it's also a very dangerous environment, and we do have President Kerry has asked for money to create more safety programs that have union involvement. So he's addressing that issue, too.
We're talking to Anne-Marie O'Neill, part-time UPS worker. She's out on Eastern Long Island in New York. And we're joined by Dave Pratt, who is a former UPS loader and an organizer for the Teamsters for a Democratic Union. Before I ask you about TDU, Dave, what about the fact that the chief negotiator for UPS, who's management, and also the head of UPS, both were former Teamsters?
Well, UPS is an unusual company. It has a long history of recruiting from within into management. So it is unusual in that way. It's not unusual in that when they rise through the ranks, and there are very select few, obviously, they control incredible shares of stock, numbers of stock, and you know, their wealth relative to what people are making, obviously, is incredible.
Dave, can you describe briefly what Teamsters for Democratic Union is, which supports Teamster leader Ron Kerry? And then I want to ask you about the investigation of Kerry as a result of his win over Jimmy Hoffa Jr., and whether you think it has to do with him representing an increased militancy on the part of the Teamsters.
Mm-hmm. TDU is a national rank-and-file Teamster organization. It has been fighting since 1976 to reform what has probably been one of the most corrupt unions in the United States, and quite successfully. Many of the positive changes in the union, the right to vote for national officers, the new leadership that was elected in 1991, and again last year, a lot of these positive changes have come as a result of the TDU members who are out there in the field, not just at UPS, but at many other companies, working day-to-day to change their locals and get members involved, reform bylaws, elect good stewards. That's what TDU is about.
And the investigation?
The investigation,
This is a federal investigation?
Exactly. There's an election officer that oversees the election process in the Teamsters. She is also empowered to investigate any possible problems with the election. We think that's a good thing, that the role she has played is a positive one, that the election was probably one of the most democratic union elections ever. Partly as a result of that. And if she finds through her investigation that there are problems, they should be dealt with.
What about this issue of the increased militancy of the Teamsters? I mean, even taking on UPS in this way, extremely significant strike, to say the least, with, 200,000 UPS workers on strike, almost that, not to mention the amount of business and consumers that will be affected by this. But here you have Kerry taking this right to a strike.
I think Kerry has our best interests in mind. And I noticed that I've been watching the news shows, and Murray, the UPS negotiator, Dave Murray, keeps saying that the union should let the Teamsters vote on the contract proposal.
That's right, that it should be taken to the
right
file.
Well, on July 13th, the Teamsters overwhelmingly voted, I think it was over 95% across the entire country, voted to authorize a strike vote if Ron Kerry found it necessary. Because they have complete faith in Ron Kerry, and they know that he's fighting for a fair contract, not anything more than that. They tell us that we're being greedy. UPS are the greedy ones. They do not want to share the wealth that they have made on the backs of their people.
I see that there are a number of unions that are supporting you, at least the pilots that are a separate union that take UPS packages, that fly the UPS planes. They're out in strike in sympathy. Is that right, Dave Pratt?
Yes. In fact, they took out an advertisement last week letting everyone know that they would support the picket lines. They've been struggling, over a year to try to get a contract on their own. Also, the mechanics, repair the trucks and so on, are supporting supporting the strike.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us, Dave Pratt and Anne-Marie O'Neill. Dave Pratt, an organizer for Teamsters for Democratic Union, TDU, and Anne-Marie O'Neill, a part-time UPS worker out in Long Island, New York. And we'll keep our listeners certainly updated on the UPS strike. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll talk about Scientology. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and that music is Fela. Fela died yesterday, and later in the show, we'll talk about this international music giant. Last week on Democracy Now!, we took a look at the controversial Church of Scientology, whose activities have been hitting the headlines both at home and abroad in recent months. More than 1,000 Scientologists in Frankfurt, Germany, chanted slogans and songs borrowed from the U.S. Civil Rights Movement last month, alleging that they're victims of religious persecution. A number of German states and organizations have banned Scientologists from participation in political parties, and the German government recently voted to allow the country's intelligence agency to keep tabs on members in Germany. The French parliament designated Scientology a sect, included on a list of 173 groups that should be tracked to prevent cult activities. And in Los Angeles, at least three public school teachers are using Scientology teachings in their classrooms, and one of them is hoping to establish a separate tax-funded charter school using the same methods. Well, after we had our guests on last week, it was last Friday, Flo Conway and Jim Siegelman, who are authors of Snapping, America's Epidemic of Sudden Personality Change, we were flooded with calls in reaction to Friday's show. Among the people who called was Bill Moon, who's a longtime Scientologist. He's a financial services professional based in Southern California. And so we asked Bill if he would join us today to talk with one of the guests we had Friday, Jim Siegelman, who's co-author of the book Snapping. We're also joined in our studio here in New York by John Carmichael, who's a spokesperson for the Church of Scientology. And we welcome you all to Democracy Now!
Good to be here.
Hi, Amy. It's good to be back.
Well, before we talk about what our guests who are Scientologists, what your objections were to the show on Friday, I thought it would be good for listeners who didn't get a chance to hear Friday's show for Jim Siegelman to make your points briefly about what you feel Scientology is and its dangers are.
Thanks, Amy. Well, Flo Conway and I have been studying not just Scientology, but literally dozens and several hundred different cult and self-help and extreme religious movements over the last 20 years. Our research in Snapping, which was published first in 1978, was really exploring the effects on the mind of the ritual practices, communication rituals, religious rituals, sometimes meditation and mind-altering rituals, that all this whole range of groups used. And when we set out to study this phenomenon of sudden change in people's minds snapping from one state to another, very quickly, as we headed across the country, we heard more stories of people who underwent these incredible changes. And far and away, the first Scientologist and former Scientologist we spoke with in our interviews then told us stories that just blew our minds. And for 20 years, we've been researching this phenomenon and these organizations and their practices. The study in the new second edition of Snapping was a nationwide study that won a National Mental Health Association Award, in which we studied 48 different groups and over 350 members of these groups and former members. What we found there was that the ritual practices of the so-called Scientology tech, their auditing and training regimens, seem to have a capacity to do devastating physical and mental and emotional damage to some of their members and former members.
John Carmichael, what is Scientology?
Well, look, first of all, I want to say one thing. I'm glad that I see that Flo is not brought along. Flo normally says she's a doctor, has a doctorate, and I've tried to ask her where she got her doctorate. Jim got in the way last time I asked her, said she didn't have to answer those questions. The credibility of Mr. Siegelman is very low to begin with. Scientology, if we talked about a real sociologist or somebody who knew something about Scientology and who actually studied Scientology, we would be talking about one of, say, these dozen people. I have a dozen studies here, and I have a dozen more of actual experts, the world's foremost authorities on religion, professors of sociology, professors of religion from France, from Germany, from all over the world, who say Scientology is a religion in the fullest sense of the word. That's what it is. Scientology, to answer your question, is an applied religious philosophy. It's one people use and are using around the world in 3,200 churches, missions, and groups, as I say, in more than 100 countries, to make their life better. And everything that Mr. Siegelman has said about Scientology, is said on Friday, and who he repeats again and again, is contradicted by not just myself, but by literally millions of people who have real experiences with the Church of Scientology and religious experts who studied the church.
Well, what is it, though, that you believe? And I know that's a tough question. I mean, if you asked a Jew, if you asked a Christian, if you asked a Muslim, just what do you believe? I don't know if it's a very easy answer, certainly to answer briefly, but how do you distinguish yourself as a religion from these other religions?
Well, Scientology's idea is that, one, man is basically good and that he's seeking to survive, and that through some Scientology techniques, people can become more control of their lives and can regain their own happiness, their own self-respect. That they can, as they increase their own freedom, they become more responsible and saner.
And do you believe in an outside God?
God is definitely part of Scientology, but we don't have a dogma about God. A person can be a part of any other religion and also be part of Scientology. We don't exclude people. And that's an important point. I should mention that Scientology is probably the fastest growing religion in the world today. If you dropped over to the Church of Scientology over in just off Times Square, there's also another one uptown, and there are churches, as I say, all over the world.
Is the main headquarters in Los Angeles?
Yes, the international headquarters is in Los Angeles. But people are invited anytime the church is open, 7 days a week. You can come in, you can find out what it is, what it's about. Its first book that dealt with the information about Scientology was Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health, a bestseller by L. Ron Hubbard that remains a bestseller to this day. It sold 18 million copies around the world, and where various other books have gone, pop psychology books have gone out of print and gone bye-bye and so forth, the Church of Scientology and Dianetics, Modern Science of Mental Health have just kept on growing.
Bill Moon, let me bring you into this conversation from Los Angeles. How did you get involved with Scientology?
Well, I read the book Dianetics, just like John was saying.
And what were you most taken with?
Well, I was thinking here were maybe the answers that I was looking for, because I was working in a small city in Colorado, pretty much out of it, really. I mean, I'd come back from Vietnam. I completed my school. I was pretty much lost as a person, because you came back and you were pretty much the object of rejection by society. You know, because this is back in the 1970, 71, and we were not. You come back in the middle of the marches and you were now a bad guy because you went to fight in Vietnam. Not that you had any choice. And I was denied work because of that and other things, and I was pretty much lost as a productive member of society. And I read the Dianetics book, and here were answers. So I went and checked it out. Read the book and said, if it's true, I got to try it.
If what's true?
If the data about how the mind works, about how people work, about why, you know, what people are trying to do, basically. And it was, you know, basically trying to survive. But there were like reasons why that you may not be surviving so well. And you study the what we call it, the techniques, the data, the teachings.
Bill, could you explain what one of those techniques is?
Well, you're talking about the various techniques of calling back from technology. One of which, let's talk about one that I had big wins on, and that's just on communication techniques. Because Mr. Hubbard, among other things, was a great communicator, a great writer, but what a communicator, and he actually broke communication down into a component parts, and you actually had drills on that so you can improve your communication skills. And those are like, that's the foundation of getting along with folks.
What do you think of the fact, for example, that France has ruled that Scientology is a cult?
Well, I think they're stupid. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. Because if you're talking about what is, what is man looking for? You're in a church. You're looking for something that improves your life, gives you more understanding about yourself and about your relationship with the universe and with the Supreme Being, whatever name you call that, and it makes your life better. And now you have, unfortunately, there are people in the world that don't think you should be improving your life, or don't think that you have to stop that or something. Because there might be a fear of something different. Who knows?
Bill Moon is on the phone with us from Los Angeles, a longtime Scientologist who called in last week after a show in Scientology and said that this religion has improved his life. Again, the idea of Scientology being a religion is controversial. It is accepted in this country as a religion. In some countries, it isn't. It looks like everyone's about to jump out of their seats, but I have to go to Jim Siegelman, co-author of Snapping, America's Epidemic of Sudden Personality Change, and you've been trying to speak
Amy.
Since...
Thanks, Amy. Your guests that here and on the phone have had their say and tried to describe their organization.
You talked for 15 minutes last week. And
excuse me, Mr. Carmichael. I didn't interrupt you, sir. You opened your statement as a propagandist for your organization by attacking my co-author who isn't here, and you've been spreading this disinformation for 2 decades.
Okay.
Neither my co-author or I have ever called ourselves doctors.
Then
my
why did you prevent her from answering the question when I asked her?
John, let's have people speaking one person at a time. And
I think,
Jim, I just wanted to ask you to respond to what Bill and to what John Carmichael have said, the idea that this is a religion. Bill says it helped him. It helped him a better person and get by after he came back from Vietnam.
What we document in Snapping, Amy, is that how people have been lured into this group by things like the Dianetics books with the massive publicity campaigns they've had for 2 decades. And they've sold many copies, and there have even been reports that Scientologists have gone into bookstores to help get the book on the bestseller list. The other thing that's important to learn, though, is that it's through this book Dianetics, through the free personality test that Scientologists offer in their centers and on street corners, that people can be lured into an organization that, for the people we've talked with who have come out of this group, can be wind up being a very different group, a group that some of their so-called communication practices and training regimens and their auditing counseling effectively induce altered states in these people that can make them utterly suggestible and totally subject to the command of the leaders of this group.
Explain exactly what you mean. The problem with any particular group, I would think, comes if it is coercive.
Yeah.
How do you think Scientology is that?
That's the problem, Amy, and that's what we've been looking at for 20 years and why on a program like Democracy Now! It's important to point out that what was originally called things like brainwashing or coercive persuasion when it was first discovered as a phenomenon in the 50s in Korean prisoner of war camps, what's going on in the United States is not coercive persuasion. It's a form of covert induction of ongoing trance states and suggestible states and the kinds of rituals that these groups use, using all kinds of the psychobabble like L. Ron Hubbard's language, that will bring people into these groups. And we have talked to literally hundreds of people who've come out of this group who said that they literally became trapped in a group, both mentally and emotionally.
How trapped?
All right, well, Scientology has its training regimen that by its own statements it conducts in a state of reverie. These are really trance-inducing self-hypnotic and hypnotic states, which is what auditing is. And we've talked to people literally who've come out of these groups, and we documented in Snapping, who were suffering floating between altered states, depression, difficulty concentrating, suicidal tendencies, hallucinations, delusions for up to 12 years after they left this group. And it's only when they come out of the group and they're separated from these techniques that they really come to understand what's happened to them in the group.
John Carmichael, spokesperson for the Church of Scientology.
You know, really, the problem, Jim, is that you're a retro character. The fact is, you supported Ted Patrick when he was out kidnapping people. You interviewed him for Playboy. You support this whole idea that somebody else should tell people what they should think and they should believe. And I want to tell you, that doesn't wash anymore. You misrepresented what happened, for instance, in France. What happened in France was that the courts said the Church of Scientology is, in fact, a religion. in according to Article 9 of the Declaration of Human Rights and Article 18 of the European Convention. And what happened was the French Interior Minister came out and said, oh, no, I am the one who can decide what is religion and what is not. In fact, the French government had already represented to the UN that they were willing to that they followed the UN Convention on Human Rights, and that's what the court followed. So, in fact, the court, the French government said, no, the court is right, not the Interior Minister. You came on the show the other day and said how horrible it is Europe is fighting this new influx of religion. Well, the truth is, Jim, people are thinking for themselves in Europe. And people are, and there are some European governments that are trying to stop that. The German government's attack on individual Scientologists, not the Church of Scientology, individual Scientologists has been condemned by the UN Commission on Human Rights, the US State Department, the Helsinki Watch, and almost a dozen other groups. But you want to stand in opposition to that? That's okay. But let me say one other thing. You talked about Russia, how sad it is in Russia. Well, I'll tell you, the Russian parliament passed a law that that wanted to stop all these other groups, not just Scientology, but a whole bunch of other groups, including the Baptists, from disseminating and getting out the religion in Russia. Now, you said you thought that it was very sad that that these groups were growing in Europe. Well, I think it's a great thing. And you know what? The United States thinks that human rights and religious rights is a good thing in Germany, in Germany and in Europe too. And that's why they have condemned the action of Germans against individual Scientologists, and why President Clinton specifically urged Boris Yeltsin to veto that religious freedom bill.
I want to bring Bill Moon back into this discussion. Jim Siegelman talked about states of reverie and hypnotic states. Have you participated in any of those, and do you think that is a fair description?
I can't think of something further from the truth. There is not. I can't say I participated in that because it doesn't really exist as such. Listen. Scientology exists to make people more aware, not less aware. And that's just what happens. As you get more, more training in communication or in how life works or whatnot, you become more aware. You become more active, happier, and you're more able. This is the sick. This more able.
Well,
and
I want
you don't do that by being asleep. You don't. You just don't.
I think that, Amy, one of the things that both your guests are showing, I mean, they're spokesmen for the Church of in official and unofficial capacities, and despite Mr. Carmichael's personal attacks on me and my co-author, the record is shown in our testimony, in the study we've done in snapping, and people can read that in our book, but they don't have to go to our book. All over the Internet now, documents are pouring out from court cases, court decisions, sworn testimony, and affidavits. If your listeners want to go to Alt Religion Scientology, the news group, or go to any search engine on the Internet and type in the word Scientology and affidavits, David, you will come up with dozens and dozens of cases of sworn testimony, much of it now emerging from former higher-ups in this group, the formerly highest-ranking members of this group.
Oh, the highest rank is preposterous. Check the Scientology website,
Scientology.org. Who have come out of this group and are telling stories.
See the real stuff. Come into the church and see for yourself. Don't listen to this.
We're
going
to have to wrap up. Why don't we wrap up on that note of the websites? John Carmichael, the website of Scientology?
www.scientology.org. See for yourself, come into a Church of Scientology. It really doesn't make any difference what Jim Siegelman says. It doesn't make any difference what I say. It's what you see for yourself. Read Dianetics of Modern Science and Mental Health. Read A New Slant on Life, a hot new book by L. Ron Hubbard that's on the stands right now. You can read it. You can see for yourself. You don't have to listen to some
other
guy.
And I think your listeners should be very very spurious of this organization. I think people in government, I think the celebrities that endorse this group, and I think public officials and mental health professionals have got to understand the potential dangers of this group and the record already emerging of some of its abuses.
Jim, the website, we have www.scientology.org, which is the Scientology's website, the website that is critical of it.
Your listeners should go to the news group, Alt Religion Scientology, or go to any search engine and type in Scientology affidavits, and you'll get the sworn testimony of former high-ranking members of this group.
Well, for now, we're going to leave it at this. We're going to continue the discussion. We have gotten a tremendous number of calls on this. Let me give out our phone number again, and let me give out our email address. Our phone number is 202-588-0999, extension 313, for people to call in. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. We'd like listeners to call in and share your own experiences, whether you're part of the church, not a part of the church, were a part of the church. If you'd like to email us, you can write to us at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. I want to thank Bill Moon joining us from Los Angeles, and thanks, Bill, also for calling in to our comment line so that we could get in touch with you. Bill Moon, a Scientologist from Southern California. John Carmichael, a spokesperson for the Church of Scientology in New York City. And Jim Siegelman, co-author of Snapping, America's Epidemic of Sudden Personality Change. It's published by Still Point Press in New York. Thanks very much, and it's a conversation that's ongoing. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Attention, quick march, slow march, left turn, right turn, a button, double up, salute, pull your hand, turn the piece, fall in, fall out, fall down, get ready, attention, quick march, slow march,
This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Musical giant and political activist Fela Kuti died this weekend at his home in Lagos, Nigeria. His family said that Fela died of heart failure caused by AIDS. He was 58 years old. Fela burst on the world music scene in the 1970s with his political Afrobeat music. With his bands Nigeria 70, Africa 70, Egypt 70, and Egypt 80, he recorded more than 50 albums, many of which featured only two or three lengthy songs apiece. In both his music and politics, he challenged a string of Nigerian military regimes, including the current dictator, Sani Abacha. As a result, Fela has spent much of his life behind bars. That's the music of Fela. He's a Nigerian musician known around the world. He died yesterday in Nigeria. The reports are that he died of AIDS. We're joined now by Jebel Fai. He is the producer of Radio Cancan, which is an African music show on Pacifica station WBAI in New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jebel.
Thank you, Amy. You're glad to be here.
Tell us about Fela.
Well, you know, Amy, Fela is a cat that we could be sitting here talking about for the next couple of hours. But given the nature of Democracy Now!, I think that I would like to tell you that Fela is the most renowned musician or skilled musician, I would say, in Africa. But he was also a politician and a social hero within the Nigerian society and also all over the Pan-African world. Fela is actually one of the only one African musician I have seen live who come up and introduce himself as, yes, indeed, I just happened to be born in Nigeria, but I'm an African. So you would actually, in some words, you should say that Fela is a Pan-Africanist of, you know, of the caliber of like Kwame Nkrumah's and the progressive forces of the 60s. And that's actually what made his fame, because of his views and his sense of self-determination for African, not just musicians, but politicians and everyday, you know, man that most people weren't really thinking about. And through the process of doing his art, he has developed his own language. His own language in two different ways. One, Fela has used the colloquial language of the streets of Nigeria and brought it into the world platform. And what is significant about that, Fela understood that most Nigerians or Africans in general were not educated in a Western sense of the word education. And he also wanted to make sure that his message is understood. But given the fact that he was educated, let's say, in the late 50s in England, he went to Oxford Trinity College in Oxford, London, he actually found it in his mind and heart to go beyond actually the academic approach of speaking or communicating to the people. So he went down to his roots, to the streets of Lagos, and used that language and so that he could be understood by more people. And in fact, the name of this program is Democracy Now! Fela has some interesting thing to say about democracy. And one of his main concerns is the fact that, you know, how do you talk about democracy in a country where less than 20% of the population is educated to at least be able to read and write and have some kind of analytical view of what is going on in the political scene? So basically, Fela actually is practicing his own vision of democracy, which is to somehow to communicate with the people by ways of, you know, of the average man in Lagos.
Fela is Nigerian. Right now, Nigeria is run by a military dictator, Sani Abacha. What was his relationship with him?
He had a very harsh, actually, relationship with the government, with all the, actually, military government in the past in Nigeria. Because mind you that Fela, from the late 60s up until now, he never stopped, actually, getting involved into the political scene in Nigeria and in Africa in general. And actually, he even went farther than anybody else, even the politicians, by making a tune called Zombie, whereby he's actually outlining the psychological pattern that one should expect from a soldier, from a military, because people were basically speculating over the fact that are these soldiers really capable of running a country? And there were debates, and the soldiers themselves also were part of the debate, trying to explain, trying to convince the people and even the world, like Abacha is doing right now, that they can actually have an analytical view that is needed to run a country. And Fela made a tune called Zombie. And in Zombie, he's telling the people that stop wondering if this guy can think or run a country. This is a soldier. A soldier is trained to take orders and follow orders. And in fact, when you look carefully in the army, those who follow orders are the ones actually that really go far. Like the generals, no matter how smart they might be, they actually promote it because they know how to follow orders from you know, their bosses. And actually, he went on and trying to explain to them that stop expecting this Nigerian or militaries in general, stop expecting so much out of them. They cannot think the way me and you are thinking because they're conditioned actually to take orders. And that was actually one of his most famous tunes, and people love it all over Nigeria, even here in New York City.
Open your hat, stand by things, fall in, fall out, fall down, get ready, hot! Order! One more time, everybody. Attention, quick march, slow march, left on, right on.
That's Fela singing Zombie. Fela died yesterday in Nigeria. He died in Lagos, the capital. And reports are that he died of AIDS.
Yes, indeed. They've been actually, Fela has been killed a couple of times over the year. And what is interesting is, like, just at least 3 months ago, some of my listeners called here and, oh, is it true that Fela died? And, you know, Fela has been dealing with death for quite a long time. And interestingly enough, he was born as Fela Ransom Kuti. That's his family full name. He changed his name into Fela Anukulapa Kuti. And what Anukulapa stands for is the one who keeps death in his pouch. So, you know, when you talk with Fela, we've been trained, actually, kind of conditioned to actually not be death is part of Fela's life, basically. But the report about the AIDS is very critical. It is true, because I heard it before, but, you know, you never know. But now that they're saying that his brother, who used to be once the health minister in Nigeria, came out in a press conference with the whole family to, you know, to basically say that he died of AIDS. And, you know, I think it's very interesting, because I look at Fela as Africa's most beloved bodyguard. Africa is like a human being, and Fela is his most beloved bodyguard. Fela has thrown himself actually in between Africa and the whip. Fela has thrown himself between Africa and the bullet. Fela has even actually lost his mother because of what he believed that Africa should be or should not be, you know. And Fela also, I believe, this time around, this is his latest act of not just bravery, but this is one thing, as far as I'm concerned, to also alert Africans about this upcoming, actually, this is a disaster when we're talking about AIDS in Africa. Nobody wants to talk about it. Myself and many people, we just try to brush it off. But as we're speaking, there are more people dying of AIDS in Africa than anywhere else in the world. And by losing Fela to AIDS, hopefully this would actually force us to get in the debate and try to figure out what can we do about this phenomenon. I don't believe for one second that AIDS come from Africa, because that's the talk around, that's what they've been saying for quite a while. But at the same time, I do believe that the situation is alarming enough for even the African politicians, who seem not to want to talk about it, to come out of their shell and try to figure a way to stop this disease, however they can, or at least to get the people, to get them prepared. And inform them about different ways of, you know, how you can get it and how you can avoid to get it. So once again, Fela has thrown himself between a major crisis in, you know, between Africa and a major crisis. And the latest crisis and the latest message from Fela is for us to wake up and realize and take this disease as, you know, as a, you know, as it is. At the same time, I can tell you that the Nigerian government is actually liable in many different ways into the death of Fela, because from 1977 up until now, he has gone into some major trouble with the government. In 1977, they killed actually his mother by burning his shrine, which was his power base. And over the years, he went to jail for many times. But the latest, actually, crisis he went through, that was from February, when his shrine was raided. And they closed his shrine. And the only source of revenue, or the only way Fela can survive, is through his music. And mind you also that there are hundreds of people who don't have nothing to do with Fela, who live actually around the shrine. Fela feeds hundreds of people that he doesn't have much to do with. People who just come to him and expect to get something from Fela. So by shutting down his power base, his only source of revenue, what the Nigerian government did is to actually accelerate his death. And in many different ways also, there are people who suspect that he might have caught the disease through actually some bigger conspiracy theory. But I don't want to get into that personally.
What about Fela Kuti's brother?
Beko was actually one of his lawyers and one of his best ally, I would say, over the years. And he is actually right now in jail also, because he was allegedly caught, you know, he was part of a group of people who wanted to you know, overthrow the government of Sani Abacha. And Beko right now is in jail, and Beko was the one that really actually fought next to Fela as a lawyer, and he's still actually part of the movement to push democracy in Nigeria.
We're talking to Jabel Fai, who is a producer of Radio Can Can, which is an African music show on Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. As we wrap up, can you describe Fela's music?
Fela's music was like beyond, actually, this is the first musician that made African music, that brought African music into, that brought it all over the world and made it very accessible music, because Fela was trained as a jazz musician and he came through had a blend of his of Nigerian rhythm, Nigerian music, mix it with jazz, funk, and soul music. And as you can hear his music, it is very accessible to many different people in the world, and people can understand it, people can identify with his music, but more so with his message. The same way Bob Marley captivated audience all over the world, that's the same way Fela has done it in many parts of the world. So the Fela's music actually is the music of unity of Africa. They call it Afrobeat. But when you hear Hugh Masekela from South Africa play Afrobeat, you would think that Hugh Masekela or Afrobeat come from South Africa, or Hugh Masekela is the creator of that music. The same way if you hear Khalam Dur from Senegal playing Afrobeat music, you would think that this is a music that they have created and it comes from their backyard. But that is the music actually that was put out there in the world by Fela Ransom Kuti, and later known as Fela Anokulapu Kuti, or better known just as Fela. So lyric-wise, Fela was one of the most outspoken musicians in the world, I would say. And musically also, in terms of the sound, his sound design and arrangement, Fela was a perfectionist, a saxophonist who believed in making his music. That's the only reason why also you will see Fela as actually the only musician who makes a 30-minute long music, because Fela believed in cooking his music to perfection. So when you listen to Fela's music, the beginning, the middle, and the end, each one of those elements have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And he's the only musician that I know of that really spent so much time in one tune. And that's the reason why you will see a Fela record with only two tunes in it. And you have to be very strong and popular and accept it for this music, this recording music, the music industry to accept that.
Jabel Fai, I want to thank you very much. Jabel Fai is the producer of Radio Can Can, an African music program on Pacifica Station WBAI in New York City. Let me give all the outro information quickly so we can hear some more of Fela, again, who died this weekend, though his music never will. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with help from Leslie George. Our engineer is Errol Maitland here in New York City. Our executive producer is Julie Drizin. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you would like to comment on today's show or any other one, you can call our comment line at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. And you can write to us by email at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. And remember, we are online on the internet. You can hear our show by going to www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!